Hello!
Let me give you a little motto I live my life by.
Bang, bang, bang the drum.
What? That's not a motto. That's just you saying a bunch of things.
It's difficult to name one favorite drummer.
Roy! Haynes!
Wow. You're amazing, dude.
Thanks. I like to play.
Drummers Weekly Groovecast.
Drummers Weekly Groovecast. Drummers Weekly Groovecast. Drummers Weekly Groovecast.
We have officially hit the halfway mark of season four of the Drummers Weekly Groovecast, John.
We're going to have an all-star break?
We are going to have an all-star break, and it's going to be that of, like, you know, when the hockey season gets interrupted by the Olympics. We're going to take like 2 weeks off. Actually, just kidding. No, we're not going to have a break like that. But season's flying by, buddy.
Well, I mean, it doesn't take a break for me to, or an Olympic jaunt to get injured.
Yeah, I heard about that, man. So, that's, you know, how's the old digit doing there?
It's not very happy.
Let me tell you, if that thing doesn't start looking a little bit better by the end of the show, man, I've got some tools downstairs. We're going to just freaking lop that thing off.
I like it. I tore up my ring finger on my right hand last night, and it doesn't look that pleasant.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't ever need that finger when you're playing drums.
Not
never.
When you just play two clubs like I do.
The old molar technique, man, the moving that fulcrum back to the third finger right there, that's going to be fun.
Golly.
It's going to be better, man. Just rub some dirt on it, right?
Just everybody be careful with your hands. I was careless last night trying to keep 11-year-old from losing his finger, and I almost lost mine. Sheesh.
See,
anyway,
the 11-year-old lost his finger. He could end up like adapting. He's got plenty of time.
That's true.
You're like decrepit. You can't adapt anymore. You're just done.
No, I just give up.
So, how has your fall been going so far, buddy? Other than nearly chopping your finger off yesterday?
Oh, it's good, man. I've been selling a lot lately, which is nice. It's kind of things are kind of back. Back in the swing, man, as far as people loosening up their pockets and what have you. So,
is it the economy, you think?
I don't know. I'm not going to get into that because then it'll just become a debate as to who's responsible for it or whatever they want to get into.
Well, I was going to
nonetheless, some people are buying some things, and that's awesome.
Did I tell you what I bought that's going to be here tomorrow?
You did not.
I didn't tell you, did I? I bought a set of Vibes.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Where'd you get them?
Man, I ended up getting, they're brand new, but they're an open box set of Marimba 1-1 Vibes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just, it's the top of the top of the top of the top.
Aren't you special?
Line. Yeah.
I get Vibes from a lot of people.
Stage bully vibes?
They're usually the lowest of the low.
So, all that to be
off
said.
Off-brand.
All that to be said, John, this fantastic space of recording that we've been using for 3.5 years, we're going to have to figure something out.
Okay.
So
let's just open a commercial studio.
I hear
the economy's improving.
That's what's going to be. That's if you want to make some cash, if you just want to print cash, just open up a recording studio. By the way, a friend of ours who does a lot of work up in Nashville told me last week that two major Nashville recording studios just shut down. And I wish I could remember the name. One of them shut down permanently. The other one is actually trying to sell. And I can't remember which two. I know it's not Sound Emporium. It's not Ocean Way. Because that's the first two that I said. I was like, oh, is it those? And he's like, no. But I can't remember which two it is. But two major ones shut down. So.
Soon to be multiple stories of young professionals living high above the street.
That's true.
Yeah, man, there's a lot of people up in arms about that. There's a lot of history being shut down up in old Nashburg.
Yeah, yeah.
Sad.
Shout out to our buddies up there. A couple of other quick things, and we'll start talking about the show today. Our show is going to be our season four version of listener mail. We got quite a bit to go through. And John, if you want to go ahead and start talking about the economy and whatnot, we'll have even more to go through by the time we get
that
to
that. Is not going to happen.
Man, I'll tell you what, I learned my lesson also, just as a quick side note, in one of my classes that I was teaching, man, just the hint, man, just an actual, just a little nudge. We were talking about society and how music, you know, develops in societies because of certain things that happen. Just nudged the political topic just a little bit, man, and it went off the rails.
On a campus? You have a death wish?
Let me tell you, I turned that thing around in a hurry. So I'm trying to avoid that.
Like the plague, bro.
Yeah. Man. A couple of quick things. A quick email that I got the other day, and it was just a little bit of, we'll call this listener confusion, or just maybe just listener not.
I forgot I sent it.
Somebody sent an email that started listening to the show this current season, just started listening to it, enjoyed the shows, and is going to do one of those things where they go back and to try to listen to all the shows. Good luck. You got a bunch of hours to listen through. But they got confused because they were listening on, I think it was iTunes, and they saw on there that we were, the latest episode that we had posted was episode, I think, 131. But it said up at the top that there are 144 episodes. And they're like, what's missing? I'm missing 13 episodes to go back and listen to. And I said, well, no, you're not. Not really, you're not. What ended up happening, if you recall, John, a couple years ago, I started doing those little mini episodes. And those are not numbered sequentially. It was like mini episode 1, 2, 3. So if you're in the same boat as that listener, you're not missing 13 episodes. There are 12 or 13 mini episodes. And that's what got the numbering off track. So there are 144 episodes, but 131 feature episodes so far. So there.
It's just Phil publicly rubbing in my face that he can play things I can't.
You say potato.
I'm just, it's just my perception there. That's all.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to show you how to get around that mashed up ring finger when we get finished today.
I'm going to become a booking agent.
And then also I want to mention really quickly, as far as like listener email, and we're not going to cover these today, but we've had a lot of really cool comments on a few of our early episodes. This first episode, Comparisons, Thief of Joy, for some reason that really struck a chord with some folks. Got a lot of nice comments and emails and messages about that. So
doesn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah, I'm somewhat. I want to do a quick Ricky Henderson here. That I want to step back and say that I'm amazed at ourselves that we can still come up with some of these topics, because I mean, it just as soon as I think that we're like we got to land this plane, all of a sudden we come up with something and it seems like people actually dig it. So
yeah, I remember 10 episodes in having anxiety about that. Like, what are we going to talk about?
Hey, let me tell you, I'm still amazed at people that do this every week. I mean, we did every week for 2 years.
Yeah,
and that was a pretty good run. But I don't see how people are doing it every week now. And that even goes for the people who are doing interviews that just do interviews. I don't see how you do it, man. I would lose my mind. I mean, it's a tough row.
I mean, you know, what factors in? You know, are you? Even if you don't have kids, that alone can make.
Well, just setting up the interviews in particular. And
yeah,
then,
that
you know,
kind of stuff is challenging.
You know, now getting back to the topic of like response, we had a tremendous response for that Steve Smith interview also. Now, that's a given. I mean,
fantastic job.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's a given that people are going to listen to that show. I mean, you just put the name up there and people are going to listen. But let me tell you, I had enough anxiety over the technical issues on that show that encompasses every drum podcaster combined. I had enough anxiety for all of us on that one because, dude, I can't even begin to tell you how many times, man, that he and I stopped, reconnected, stop, reconnect. And it was due to multiple issues on his end as far as like just having bad internet in Oregon. And then all of a sudden I started having like hardware-based issues. Mm. Man, I was losing my freaking mind over that thing. And the entire interview was ended up with all the connections and reconnections and problems and phone calls and are you still there and all that. Man, it was like 3 hours long, you know. And, man, I was literally sweating over here.
But, man. So. Listen to the content. Clearly, he was engaged, you know, because that could have gone the opposite way easily. Like, hey, you know, like, I'm done.
That could have, man, that could have been a freaking dart going into the ground right there, baby.
Kudos to both of you for patience, and especially your interview prowess is becoming.
Wow! Thank you, man.
Very, very, very
well. It also
well
helps.
Received and respected.
Let me tell you, it also helps. I've known him for a while, also, and so
a big plus.
That's a plus, man, for sure. And then also, just quick nod to the Josh Fries show that was just recently published, man. That thing took off like gangbusters, man. Got a lot of really nice feedback from that as well. People really liking it. And then, of course, you know, you always have a few people who are like, "What about The Replacements?" That was one of the first comments.
We're not gonna do a 17-day discography, you know, complete discography show on Josh. You know, but you know, I thank you to him for the inspiration, for sure. What a great player.
Yeah, hats off to Mr. Chalden there for that. That was all you.
Piece of cake. But he helps in that his social media is quite interesting. And
it's funny, man.
People are pretty into that guy. So it's easy to pick a guy like that and talk about him. Everybody wants to be a part of it and –
Let me tell you one of my favorite things that he does, aside from his playing, of course the playing, but one of the favorite things is he gets on a weird kick to where certain hotels that he goes into, he doesn't want any food in the room, like in the mini bar.
Clear out.
So he calls a concierge and has somebody come up and just take all the, and he videos them taking the stuff out of the room. It's like a weird fetish. And I'm just like, and of course I'm going to watch the 2.5 minutes of the guy taking right. food out of the minibar. It's compelling.
Did you ever see the picture of he and his wife out of the table with just junk food and cigarettes and all this?
No, I didn't see that.
It's so hilarious. Man. I mean, hundreds of dollars worth of McDonald's and cigarettes, you know.
That's what I call a bad day. What is it, you know?
I don't know. It's so funny.
Last thing, John, and then we're going to dig into our listener email for season 4. I made a post on our social media that was the first, I'll call it non-podcast related post that I've made in years. But I suppose you can probably draw a straight line and get it back to the podcast. But, man, let me tell you, I had a full circle moment a couple of weeks ago, man. And talk about old devil pride and swelling up and along with a bunch of emotions as well, man. It was, whew, man, it was powerful, man. I had a student of mine that who's a power listener to the show, guarantee he's listening to this, that he landed an arena-level gig. And sure enough, they came through the Atlanta area. Yeah. And so, man, he got me and the wife tickets to go to the gig. And it's a wonderful drummer, man, that I will guarantee you there's not a doubt in my mind that y'all are going to be hearing his name for a long time. This kid named Kyle Edmonston. He studied with me from the time he was pre-middle school, probably 9 or 10 years old, and I got him prepared all the way up until the age of 18 to go to Berkeley. He ended up getting into Berkeley, nearly a full ride up there. He's one of the few that actually graduated, ended up moving down to Nashville. Took him a few years, but, man, he is starting to make some waves up there. And so, man, it was quite an evening for me, man, to go out there and to see that guy up on the stage, man, it was a powerful moment.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to relate that to somebody until you've... Yeah, I mean, you and I have both been in that position from the standpoint that we've played some big gigs before. But, man, let me tell you, it's hard to put it in... It's hard to articulate it, man, until, you know, you get there and you see what that's like, man. It's good stuff.
I get the teacher thing too. Like, I think about some parents that I know that their kids are just stunningly talented and thinking like, man, they got to be freaking out when they go see this kid just owning it, you know?
Yeah.
So it makes perfect sense that he's kind of like a kid, one of your kids, you know?
Yeah, like I said, I've known him since he was, you know, late elementary school.
Right.
And you know, man, I don't, as far as like with the way that I teach now, it's been a long time since I've taught kids that were that young. And I really don't teach kids that young anymore. I'm more in the post-secondary level of stuff now.
Intermediate at worst.
Right. And man, when you see something like that happen, and I even included on social media that, you know, I've had some students that have gone on and have become equally successful teachers at some schools and colleges, and then I've had some that have had some other pretty significant gigs. But this is the first one that has had like an arena level style gig. You know, I've had some that have had some theater style things and clubs and that kind of, but this is the first one, man, that made it to an arena. And I don't know, it was just a very kind of a special delineated moment as far as like, that's the first one that I've had that's done that. And it was very, very cool. And I imagine, you know, some of our friends, you know, like Jack Bell and some of the, you know, they've had that numerous times, man.
No doubt.
But it was a big deal. So I just wanted to clarify that also, because I had a lot of really super cool, nice comments and likes on that. And that's the genesis of that. And that's really what it's about. So,
well, congrats, man. That's awesome.
Thank you very much. Well, let's get into listener mail, because we got a good bit of it that we've got to get through today. We've got some good general comments, and then we've got some actual questions that have to be answered as well. And let me say this. These questions that we're going to answer on the air have already been answered personally back to the individual emailer. So just keep in mind that if you do have a specific question you want to ask us, feel free to email it to us. We will get back to you personally and let you know what our answers are on these. Okay, so you get it coming and going from us. So I thought what we would do first, John, is I got a couple of just little short comments that were sent in to us, not necessarily questions, but I thought it'd be nice to just relate them to you and to the audience, and we can make comments on them as well. And the first one I want to talk about is one that came in, I guess, probably about 3 weeks ago, and it's from that damn Jim Gordon artist feature that we did. It was a year and a half ago, right? And I've told you that thing has taken a life of its own. It is unbelievable. It's now, John, the most listened to episode.
No way.
That we've done. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's way up there on YouTube, man. It's got nearly 3,000 listens. Okay.
That's crazy.
And then a whole bunch just on our regular iTunes SoundCloud platform as well. I mean, it's got a ton of listens to it. And I got a really nice, just a short comment. And I mean, this pretty much, I think, will codify why this thing has got so many listens. Just listen to this short comment right here. It says, thanks for doing the artist feature on Jim Gordon. He is the GOAT. So there are people out there, man, that think that he's the greatest of all time.
Yeah. Okay.
And I mean, that's saying something. I mean, you know. Who would have known that people would have thought of him in that way? And also, think about this. What would have happened if this guy hadn't had the mental issues and ultimate incarceration?
Oh, just not unlike Picaro, it would have been just...
There you go.
To this day.
Well, let me say
playing
this.
At a level that is inhuman.
I've always had a tremendous amount of respect for him. I've got a newfound respect for that guy right now. Because, you know, I told you and the listeners on an earlier episode that I've been dipping my toes into the world of tribute bands, right? And I've been messing around with this Eric Clapton tribute band. And there's a few tunes that that group is playing that's got Jim Gordon playing on it. Playing some of those parts in the way that he kind of conceived those parts inside of those tunes, there's some brilliance in there, let me tell you, my friend.
Yeah, he's definitely got some depth, you know. A lot of you know he wrote the outro to Layla.
Right.
So there's definitely more than just a Neanderthal bang on some drums.
Check out the drum part on Layla.
Oh, it's great.
Goes in some different directions that you don't think it's going, especially just as a casual listener. You don't think it does some of the things that it does, but then it does them, there's some interesting things, man, on there. And then, of course, you also got like Bell Bottom Blues. I mean, come on. I mean, let's just play it backwards, right? So, yeah.
Well, then when you got, the guys in charge really, really high, you get to just play whatever you want.
That was a drug-fueled session right there, my friend. Yeah. All right, let's go on to comment number two. This one's a little
bit... I need to do some more sessions with guys that are really high. That'd be awesome.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Dang
All right. Comment number two. This is a little bit of a longer one, okay? And it says, hey, Phil, I wanted to congratulate you guys on a fantastic episode 127. Now, episode 127, let me go back and be completely and totally transparent on this. This was the episode that actually aired on our buddy Patrick Ferguson's podcast platform, Crash and Ride Podcast. I was a guest on his show back in late winter, okay? It says, want to congratulate you guys on a fantastic episode 127. In recent years, particularly since the passing of my dad and best friend, I'm realizing that I'm more prone to anxiety than I had previously realized. Hearing people like yourself talk so openly and honestly about it is absolutely huge for the rest of us. It says, I probably wouldn't have described myself as someone who had anxiety issues a few years ago, but I see now that it was always there. I just experienced more acute symptoms during stressful times. Thanks for being so honest and brave in talking about it. I have a feeling you're going to get a big response to this episode because it's going to touch a lot of people. This is from Larry through email.
Nice.
That was nice.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a whole lot more of that mindset going on than plenty of us want to admit. You know, I think in some regards, the drummer ego and machismo and what have you can kind of mask some of that. And also, it's this business is so competitive, man. You don't want to give anybody a leg up like, oh, John is, he's really, he gets kind of nervous. Sure you want to hire him? That kind of crap. So, but man, it as we have seen with mental illness regularly, it can manifest into some really dark stuff, and it just face it, really try to face it and own it in some regards too, because I think you have a better chance of getting past it or at least managing it as opposed to stuffing it down and burying it.
Absolutely. And it's a good time to go ahead and just give Patrick another plug for his show called Crash and Ride Podcast. That sucker won $5,000. Did you know that?
Good for him.
Yeah, he won $5,000. He got a grant from, I can't remember what organization gave him the money, but it was, I guess, I don't know, maybe like three or four months ago that he submitted his show as a show that was doing something, towards mental health, and this was a new angle. And he's done a great job with that show, if you've heard any of it, man.
Yeah,
he's done a real good job.
I'm thinking, I'm kind of jealous. I'm thinking about kind of going off the rails and doing something crazy. So maybe
you can get
he
on
asked
there.
Me to be on there.
All right, John, so here's our first question.
Wait. I want to let that sink in a minute, so when he hears that, he'll feel bad. No, I don't want to be on his show.
Using reverse
psychology. He'd lose his grant if I went on that show.
You're using reverse psychology. And I don't want to be on his show. Ah.
He'd lose that grant and be like, that guy, that's a different kind of crazy. We don't want to be associated with that.
So, John, our first question that we do have an answer for came from a gentleman named Scott via email. And this is one of those that, you know, you might think that this is a no-duh kind of answer, but obviously it's not. This is something, you know, people still have questions about this. And essentially the first question is short and simple. Excuse me. I got choked up. How do you fix a single broken snare wire? Also, how do you know if it's time to change out a full set of snares? John, you want to go or you want me to go first?
Well, clearly, you know, taking wire snips or something like that and pulling that snare back and cutting it is the best solution. And it's not going to affect the sound of the snare drum much. Of course, you always want to leave about a quarter of an inch so you can cut yourself regularly. That's important. Yeah. But other than that, no. All joking aside, you know, just cutting that away is a good solution, especially if money's tight or if you're, you know, not going to get to a store soon or you can't order something and get it quickly. There's an easy solution. As far as when to change them, I'm not a good person to ask that because I'll leave stuff on for 400 years given the choice.
I am very similar to that. And to me, the easiest question or the easiest answer for that is if you have multiple broken snares.
Absolutely.
If you have multiple broken snares, what that's telling you is most likely those snares have been on there so old that the welds, you know, or the brazes, I guess, where those things are brazed to the butt plates are just giving way over a period of time. That's probably the easiest way. Now, somebody like Kenny Sharitz, I mean, who's got fantastic ears. I mean, we've got good ears too, but I have never really heard a significant difference in the degradation of sound of old snares. He says he can hear it, and he says every 6 months you should change the snare wires. But I'm like you. I've got some snare wires on some drums that I'll guarantee it's 10 years old, you know, that are on there, and I don't hear a significant difference in the sound as far as like any degradation in the sound of the snare wires. To me, I hear more degradation in the sound of the drum heads, including even the snare side head, before I'm going to hear the degradation of the snares themselves.
I agree. Yeah. Snare drum heads stretched and all that. You can definitely, and even response. And you know, man, with all due respect to Kenny, and I think his ears are, you know, world class on every level, and he's proven that to be the case for obvious reasons, and his career speaks for itself. But I think we oftentimes we're still hearing with our eyes, because I got a kick drum that head's been on for 5 or 6 years, a batter head. It's like, it sounds great. I don't have a heavy foot. Why would I change it and maybe lose that mojo?
Well, especially it's muted also. So you're getting impact sound.
Totally. And so you have all of that. And then you also, you know, snare drum wise, man, I leave my head on a lot longer than I used to, but it's all about, it still sounds good. Mm-hmm. So there you have it, you know.
As long as it holds tune. Yeah. It's tunable.
If it sounds good to my ear, you know, and we all know, I don't care how good of a tuner you are, every other time you change a head on a snare drum, you know, you're like, wait, it's not as sensitive as it was, or that
or you
tone,
lost the mojo.
Where's all this overring come? You know, the overtones coming from, and so like if it's working, I leave it alone until it's unacceptable.
Yeah, John. The only thing I want to add to the like single broken snare thing is that one thing I would suggest doing also is before you actually take the snips and cut it, turn your snares off, release the snares where they hang down a little bit. That'll give you a little more room to get in there to take your wire snip, and then, as John says, snip it off to where it leaves about a half an inch so it snags every single thing you get. But now, try to cut it as close to the butt plate of the snare wires as you can, and you should be fine.
Yeah.
I suppose the only other caveat would be is this. Not many people do this, but I'm gonna throw out this this blanket statement because somebody will come up and say, well, what if it's an 8-strand snare? Because, you know, they make those. They make, you know, really small strands. Yeah, naturally, if you lose one of those strands, you might end up hearing a difference, right, on a really narrow strand of snares. So then go ahead and replace it. But if you're, you know, using a traditional 20-strand set of snares on a drum set snare drum, doubtful you're going to hear a difference with just one strand. Same thing if you're using anything bigger than that, 24-strand, 40-strand, whatever. You're going to be fine just missing one strand. So there's that.
And if you point out and use the 8-strand snare as an example, please don't ask me in person.
What are you going to do, John?
It's not going to end well for one of us.
All right. Comment number two. All right. No answer needed for this, but this is in relation or in regard to that same episode 127, Patrick's show. It says, Phil, longtime listener of the podcast. I teach drums and psychology in Lincoln, Nebraska. Says, I listen. Yeah, I listen to a good chunk of your podcast this summer on several different road trips. Says, I heard the episode today about dealing with anxiety and wanted to reach out. I have a PhD in psychology and play and teach drums locally. We have a doctor in the house.
Woohoo!
Says, this topic is greatly underserved in the drumming community. Says, I would really like to discuss this more as I've battled anxiety and depression since childhood as well. Recently, I started integrating my psych training with drums and have a small YouTube channel, Drum Psychology, on mental aspects of playing. So I feel like there's a common thread here, and I wanted to let you know how impactful this episode was. It says, I may be a resource for what you guys are describing and how the brain and neuroscientists are researching these aspects of our behavior. I know firsthand all the things you mentioned. Felt like it was describing me as well. Stunning. All the best to you. I appreciate your service to the drumming community and awareness that you are raising for us all. Frank from our Facebook Messenger page.
Right on, Frank.
Yeah, so
we should get
stuff.
Frank and Patrick linked up.
No kidding.
That might be a...
No kidding. That's a great suggestion.
Yeah.
John, you're the idea guy.
You know, I can't play Larry's Lament from Swing Solo Etudes number 48, but I can come up with an idea.
Man, there was a lot of stuff in that state. Swing Solo
Etudes.
Well,
the books
etude.
All have like some 74-letter name, so I want to make sure they knew what I was talking about.
Nice. All right, so now we go to question number two. Now, this one might take a minute to answer because when I answered this one, it took me a minute to type it out because there's some depth in this question. It's a short question, but it's got a lot of answers to it. The question is this. It's from Justin via our Facebook Messenger. It says, what questions would you ask a potential drum teacher?
Hmm.
Woo! Some depth on that one.
Yeah, that's not going to be a one-word answer.
You want to go first? You want me to?
Go ahead.
Okay. The first thing I told Justin is I said, you have to consider what level of instruction you're looking for, because he didn't necessarily say, hey, I'm a beginner, or I'm an intermediate student, or even I'm an advanced student that's maybe like trying to get into music school or whatever, that sort of thing. And so I approached it from a couple of different levels. I think I gave him answers for like beginning and then something more advanced. And essentially what I said to him is this. I said, look, if you're a beginning drummer and you're looking for a teacher, the main thing you need to be concerned with is, one, when you contact this person, how's his level or her level of communication? Is it somebody that will sit there and talk to you, or is he just trying to get you off the phone when he tries to
talk? Get you on the books.
Right. Is he trying to also communicate with you from a standpoint that you can understand it? In other words, are the things he's saying just making sense? Is he a good or is she a good communicator? That's an important thing, because if you're having problems understanding what he's saying on a phone call, chances are when you get in the lesson, it may not be great either. So that's one of the first things. And then as far as specific questions about educational aspects, John, you know that I am extremely biased towards what I call definitive traditional methods and definitive traditional teaching. it is ridiculously important to study basics from the standpoint of not just rudiments, right? But to also study the basics in method form that, especially if you're going to try to study this later on at a higher level, you need to have a good grounding in these basic methods. These are the methods that everything else that we play, even if you're playing in rock bands, jazz bands, where the things that you eventually have to play in those bands are grounded in those methods, because those methods were written out of necessity to get you to where you can play that kind of material. So ask that teacher if he's grounded in these basic methods. And like an example of, well, what are the basic methods? Like if you're talking about snare drum, is this person familiar with, say, like the Wilcoxon methods, right? Is he familiar with the NARD methods? Is he familiar with like concert snare drums? Is he familiar with like the Goldenberg method, the Cerrone book, that sort of stuff? For drum set, is he familiar with things like in the jazz idiom, say the Chapin book? Does he know how to do the systems out of the Ted Reed syncopation book? If you get a little bit more advanced, man, is he into like the Ed Sof books, Houghton books, that sort of thing? Maybe even the John Riley advanced bop drumming. If you start getting into the rock thing, does he know the Apsey book, Realistic Rock? Does he know Dowd, Funky Primer? Then you start getting into the more advanced methods of that. Does he know things like the Garibaldi, Future Sounds, Chester Newbery, that sort of thing? So you get my drift. Does this teacher have a firm foundation with that? So if you go with that, I think that's a good place to start. For the more advanced student, I think the thing that you really have to be clear with is, look, I need help in this particular avenue, right? Like, in other words, if you need to try to get your jazz better, or even if you're trying to do something inside of that, I'm trying to get my contemporary linear fusion thing together. You want to make sure that that person not only knows that material, but can play it and can demonstrate it and is really super comfortable with it. Right. So in other words, you need to be super task specific when you get a little bit more advanced. In other words, you got to ask these questions from the standpoint of like, look, I need a very narrow range of help in this, and I need to know if this is your thing. You know, I heard that it might be your thing, but look, I've got these questions for you, and I need some help in that avenue. And then likewise, also, you might be an advanced student that's wanting to get into a music school. Ask this person if they've prepared people. Have you had success getting people into music school? What are the schools? What are the things you teach them to get into those schools? Do you help me with any harmonic stuff? Like, can you help me play, you know, any kind of mallets? Just maybe get some scales together, some arpeggios, some basic reading. All that stuff, that's good stuff to ask an advanced teacher.
Yeah. Mine would be probably quite a bit different than that, just for the simple fact that I'm probably not as concerned about methods and more concerned about preparing me for what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I would probably first say, you know, like, hey, you know, teaching, awesome, but, you know, what kind of gigs do you do?
That's good. That's very good.
You know, because if he's just doing a, you know, part-time symphony thing and an occasional musical, that's not really, you know, I want to have an instructor that is going to help me understand the mechanics of a gig, not just from a application standpoint, but from a attitude and a preparedness standpoint and a you know, not overlooking, you know, the vibe and the hang and all that stuff. So then I probably get into, I would deliberately ask them, well, tell me about your, you know, your teaching and your approach to teaching. And if they went on and on about that, that would be great. You'd understand where they're coming from. But if they didn't ask me, what is it you would like to accomplish in lessons from me, I might have a red flag, because I'd be kind of like, every student's different. And I firmly believe that the best teachers, though they have a general game plan and a general approach to how they teach, they've got to be able to be flexible in regards to what the individual needs and wants. And can they, in turn, accommodate that? If it's blinders on and, hey, you're coming along with me, whether you're interested in this or not, that can be a problem, because there's some students are going to take to that and just excel in that and blindly follow. But there's some that'll be like, man, I don't really give a crap about timpani or mallet percussion, or, you know, whether the 20th through the 26th rudiment is important to me and what I want to accomplish. I want to play in a rock and roll band, but I want to have good time and good technique and eventually do recordings. So that factors in there. But those things would be more important to me. A connection, because I truly believe a good teacher, you're going to get the most out of them if you have a connection with them above and beyond the monotone, this is how it is way of teaching. That wouldn't resonate with me.
You know, John, you made a good point. And I will even further that point by saying that if you are an aspiring college student trying to get into music school, I would use that exact same template. In other words, making sure that the school that you attend puts you on the path that you want to go on, because every music school has a different sort of music path or music pathway.
Right.
And some of them you can customize, some of them you cannot. And what I mean by that is, like, if you want to go back and listen to the Carter McLean interview, he had a really bad experience at the University of Colorado where he went, to where he thought when he had gotten there that he was going to be going through this thing to primarily do drum set. And then he ended up having to go through and do like the generalized general percussion path, which that's kind of standard, right, at a lot of different schools. But there are a lot of places now that allow you to do things that are more drum set centric, you know. And so you just want to make sure that you are aware of that as a music student when you start looking at different colleges, because there's so many options that are out there now at different schools that you need to be fully aware that you might be able to find something at one school that's not offered at another, that's not offered at another.
Right.
And it might be more appealing to you. So just keep that in mind when you're looking at schools.
I remember that Carter interview resonating with me because I went through something similar in that I ended up going to a school because of the reputation of the ensembles. And that's not a great thing to...
It's a portion of it.
It you don't want to go to a school where the reputation of the ensembles suck. But at the same time, more schools than not, your experience in an ensemble is going to be pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, like even a small liberal arts college, a lot of them have a pretty good big band. They have some small group things. But if you have in my case, I had a percussion instructor who was into Japanese marimba and timpani. And when we got the drum set, you know, like I might have been on a lot of levels maybe more together than he was.
Yeah.
And that's not good. So, you know, doing that research. But it still, again, it goes back to the individual and their approach. And is it right for you?
Right.
Because that's something that, yeah, I don't care if a guy like, you know, Jack Bell's a perfect example. Like, that might not have been the right teacher for me.
Mm-hmm.
As great as he is and all the success he has, maybe it wasn't maybe it wouldn't have been a good fit for me. You know, I don't know.
Well, he'll be the first one to tell you also that with the numerous successes that he's had, he's probably had close to, if not even more, non-successes. In other words, that's just the way it is as a teacher.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, not every student is a home run. You know, you sit here and you think about Alan Dawson, you think, well, he had Steve Smith and he had, you know, Vinnie Colaiuta and all these other people. Well, not all of them are Steve Smith and Vinnie Colaiuta.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Told you that was a deep question.
Well, I mean, it's just so wide open.
Wide open. Here's the next one that it it's a series of comments that I discovered, and I thought it was kind of interesting because our listeners sort of hijacked a thread on, I think it was Drummer World Forum, and I thought this was very funny, that our show on hi-hats became a rather extended topic on a thread that they posted as probably a few weeks ago or maybe even a month or month and a half ago, something like that. And essentially, it was a thread regarding those 15-inch K light hi-hats that you and I have an affinity over. And there was a lot of banter going back and forth about what makes them the magic hi-hats and whatnot. And so I thought we would touch on that again just for a second, and also just to give mad props to our friends over at Drummer World Forum and at DFO at drumforum.org. There's always something going on over there. Somebody's talking about something that we've done. But that thread needs maybe just a little clarification. And the thing to John and I, and you can speak on this also, but there's a certain range of weight on those hi-hats that make them the magic hi-hats, because not only is the sound, but something that he and I are both adamant about, it's the actual feel of what those things feel like, not only under the stick, but with the foot as well. Mm-hmm. The one drawback that John and I think probably about the only drawback that John and I have found on those hi-hats, but there's something to this that obviously contributes to the sound, is that they have a tendency for those hi-hat edges to be a little sharp.
Or not even the same size.
Uh-huh. Yeah, to where one hat is maybe, what would you say, maybe a 16th of an inch larger than the other?
Probably.
Something like that. To where there's a little bit of a gap between that top and bottom cymbal, where the bottom has an underbite, we'll call it, of that hat, and it has a tendency to really chew up your sticks. But then again, I don't know, man. That might have something also to do with the charm of the sound and feel of those hats. I don't know, but that's my take on those 15-inch K-lights.
Yeah. I definitely got annoyed sometimes by the chewing of the stick because, you know, I don't have, like, some big-time endorsement like you do, so I got to buy them. Like, really buy them.
So, well, I was going to say, they're not just showing up on my front porch, my friend.
Well, they are.
Yeah. Well, they are, but not free.
Okay, but I mean, they still show up on your front porch, so you got to, they're not free.
That's for you, C-Dub.
Mine are less free.
But still,
if anyone wants to send me less free sticks, I'm down with that.
How many times have I told you you're a phone call away?
Yeah.
So, that's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
All right. And one last thing about those 15-inch K-lights. I have done numerous gigs and a few sessions with them. Did a session 2 months ago with those that you know as well as I do, John. Not many
You're busy.
People.
Wow.
Not many people take their time to talk about a standout pair of hi-hats. But those hi-hats seem to get noticed. Not in a bad way, as far as like, oh, those things ride out. But I mean, as far as like, wow, those things actually sound really good and fit well within what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So, man, they're pretty magic. So, and again, you know, the weight range is important. I don't have those weights right in front of me right now, but if anybody does need those weights, send us an email and we'll get them back to you. John, we've got another question we need to answer. And the question is this. And this is also going to be a little bit of an in-depth answer. And this comes from our email account. It says, "What an absolutely fantastic in-depth evaluation of Sonny Payne." Again, John, kudos to you. Says, "Sonny's one of my big heroes. The other day, I read some quotes by Mel Lewis, which he was commenting negatively on Sonny's time feel. He was hacking away on rock drummers, too. Says, in my opinion, Mr. Lewis is not eligible to comment on rock music. Says, I wonder what's wrong with this guy. Do you have any insight? This is from Lauren, again, via email. Lauren's one of our international listeners, I believe, from the Netherlands. John, what's your thought on that?
Mel, I never let Mel's opinions bother me. I've always kind of taken Mel as like, I'll just listen to his playing, and because he's just this closed-minded, cranky old bastard, and it was like, that's not important to me. You know, that's not what jazz is. You know, like if you're truly in the spirit of jazz, forward thinking is what's up. But there's also that elitist thing, and I'm just like kind of like, I'm not going to let all that nonsense cloud my appreciation of his playing. So I suggest doing the same thing. Just don't read his opinions. that's helped me.
John, when I responded to that email, one of the first things that I wrote down is that don't underestimate the generational gap. In other words, what it's like to be of his generation in the type of comments, because he's not the only one that's like that.
Oh.
I mean, it goes without saying, even though I'm going to say it, that was there anybody really more outspoken than Buddy Rich?
Oh, we're still talking about modern drumming or anything?
Anything.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Because, I mean, he would go off about drummers using what he called timpani grip, which is matched grip, right? He would go off on that. And then, you know, there were times that he would get upset and talk about different styles of music. Like, he hated country music. He hated pop music. Although, you know, I think it's kind of funny that he ended up recording some pseudo-pop kind of stuff with his big band. He had his daughter, Kathy, singing like The Beat Goes On, you know, back in like 1968 or whatever it was.
Beatles song.
Yeah, Beatles song, Norwegian Wood, you know, that sort of thing. But I think it's as much of a generational thing. And like you said also, which kind of maybe even encompasses that a little bit of that elitist jazz type thing. But, you know, let me say one thing that is, as everybody is a human contradiction, right? There was something that you said that I thought was really interesting. You were like, well, you know, in the spirit of jazz, jazz is a forward thinking kind of a thing, right? Trying to create new things. You know, something that Jeff Hamilton told me, because I would have to say that Jeff is probably the closest thing that we got right now to like a Mel Lewis kind of a person, because he studied rather significantly under Mel Lewis. He told me that one of his, and it's also one of my favorite things that Mel Lewis ever did, was he played in the Terry Gibbs big band, Terry Gibbs vibist, and there was a series of records that came out that were lost, came out, I don't know, probably in the mid to late 80s, that were from the late 50s. And it was just this really super hard swinging Terry Gibbs dream band is what they called it.
Had a lot of L.A. band, right?
L.A. band.
Yeah.
And Jeff said that when he mentioned those recordings to Mel, that Mel was like, ah, it's a bunch of crap. It's a bunch of dance band stuff. He goes, I don't even want to listen to any stuff that I played on back then. He was all about like the more advanced, contemporary, heady Thad Jones, Mel Lewis orchestra stuff. Because, I mean, you can't get any more different composition and performance style stuff, right, that they did. Very contemporary, very forward-leaning, as opposed to, like he said, the Terry Gibbs stuff was pretty much dance band stuff. They were playing pop tunes, right, standards.
Yeah.
But, boy, man, does it swing hard.
His whole experience in L.A. sort of tempered that whole mindset about anything that's just sort of remotely commercial, because he did he did sessions that were beneath him,
I believe it was Hamilton that mentioned also that he had a bad taste from some of that LA stuff, that some of the different people he worked under, whether it be sessions or in bands, didn't like some of his sounds, like cymbals and drums, and they made him like use brighter sound and cymbals, and that was not a thing that he really subscribed to, that he really liked having his old K's and the dark sounds and calfskin heads and that kind of stuff. So I think you're right. There's something in that too. So John, we got what I'm considering to be saving the best for last.
Oh, okay.
This is from one of our power listeners, somebody who's listened, I think, to every episode, and he's a very vocal contributor as well. He stays in touch with us, and he communicates via email and through our social media posts. It's our buddy Steve that's from up in the Cleveland, Ohio area. And man, you're not my friend if this doesn't get you, man. This is a feel-good story. And you know, John, he sent some pictures with this as well that if you haven't seen them, I think I'm going to ask him if we can post them on our social media, because it really brings the point home. But anyway, this is from our friend Steve up in Cleveland. And he sent this, it's probably about a month ago. And he goes, I lost a drummer friend named Mark Hurst to a brain tumor last year. He says, before he passed away, he asked me to handle the sale of all of his gear for his wife. He had a Gretsch round badge, 22-13-16 in yellow satin flame. And he had a 70s Ludwig double bass kit in white Cortex. Says he was a real gigging drummer. Says having started the Cleveland group called the Burnt River Band. Says he used that double bass Ludwig kit in gigs all over the country, including the Big Harley Rally in Sturgis, South Dakota. Says when I picked up the drums, I was bummed because they were in rough shape. Says these were the only drums that Mark played over his 40-plus year career, and he was really not a gear geek like some of us. It says the Gretsch kit was missing a bunch of parts and the finish was really dirty. It says the Ludwigs were a tad better, but needed a good cleanup and needed all the stripped parts replaced. It says I never had the skills nor the time to actually fix them up, so I tried to sell them here in Cleveland along with being on Reverb and Craigslist. It says after selling off a lot of the vintage hardware, I took the rest of the drums to Steeble's Drums and sold them to the shop. Says Mark's wife was really happy with what I was able to get for her. Says Steeble's cleaned up and repaired the Gretsch kit and sold him. Says then Steeble's got a call from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They needed instruments for their new The Garage interactive exhibit there at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Says there visitors can sit down and play whatever instruments they like. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame have guitars, basses, keyboards, and now a refurbished white vintage Ludwig kit. Says Mark is surely smiling up in heaven.
I don't doubt it. That's incredible.
That's, if that doesn't get you.
I love that.
Woo! That's good stuff, man. And he sent, like I said, a few pictures of that big double bass kit set up along with, you know, there's guitars and basses and stuff like that that you can just kind of get your picture taken with, and you can sit around and tap around on them. And I'm going to ask him if we can post some of those pictures on our social media, because that's good stuff, man. That's the kind of stuff you need to post on social media.
I'm going to ask you to see that one of my kits is left at the Beer Hall of Fame.
Johnny's Hideaway.
No. And somewhere like it just, because I drank a lot more beer than I did practice. So it should go to that Hall of Fame as opposed to anything music related.
John, I don't want to paint you into a beer corner. All right. But I'm going to.
I hate IPAs there. I said it.
Well, no, I'm going city wise here. The two big beer cities, and we're not going into this microbrewery crap. The two beer cities. One you're from, or you spent a good amount of time there, St. Louis, and the other one just up the road, Milwaukee.
Yes, sir.
You got to put a gun to your head. Are you drinking Milwaukee beers or St. Louis beers? Don't look at me like that.
It doesn't even warrant an answer.
No, it does warrant an answer.
No. Not with who I'd have to answer to.
Okay, so I'm going to say it. He's Miller Milwaukee beers.
Maybe if Hank Aaron were still there.
All right, folks. That's going to do it for today and for our Season 4 listener mail. We appreciate you guys staying in touch with us. We really do. It's fun getting back to you guys and, you know, you guys staying in touch with us and letting us know what you think about the shows and whatnot. Keep those emails, keep those messages coming. You can always reach out to us through our DrummersWeeklyGroovecast.com website. That's where we got a bunch of the emails for this show. You can always reach out to us at our social media. We got some Facebook messages and Instagram messages as well. We're also active on Twitter. Of course, you can always subscribe to that and like the show on any of those platforms, or you can do it through our website as well. Again, DrummersWeeklyGroovecast.com. Also, when you have a minute, if you would, please swing by iTunes if you're an Apple platform person. Leave us a quick 5-star review. Really helps us out, helps people find the show and listen to it. Seems like every time we start a new season, we get an influx of new listeners, which is really nice. People are like, I wasn't sure, never heard of the show before, and now I'm listening to all of them. So, yeah, anytime that you can get into iTunes and leave us a quick 5-star review, that would surely help us. We'd greatly appreciate it. John, anything else, buddy?
This bud's for you, baby.
Oh, there you go. Milwaukee lives. See y'all next week.